You're listening to Conversations That Matter with your host, Terry Conrad.
So, thank you so much for coming. This is our very first Conversation That Matters. And because it's brand spanking new, we've never done this before, it's probably going to be a little bit clunky, but I did want to sort of introduce Conversations That Matter. So what it is it's intelligent conversation with people on purpose, very much like you, Michael Thorne. And the entire passion behind this was because there's so much noise in the world, and because we have so little time, that so many of our conversations seem to be remaining very surface and superficial. And I've just been craving digging a little bit deeper and getting to know the people a little bit better, and having conversations that are maybe a little bit more important besides just the surface stuff that we tend to be covering more often. So with that being said, let me now introduce you. This is Michael Thorne. Thank you so much for joining us, Michael.
Thank you.
I am going to take a little bit of a page out of your playbook and just read your Twitter bio, just because it covers the basics, I think, very well. So Michael is a realtor with RE/MAX Little Oak. He is the co-host of Mobile Agent TV and the co-founder of My North Langley. And he has been named one of Inman News' top 100 most influential members in real estate, which is unbelievable. So now that I've sort of spit that out, there's a few things in there that I actually sort of want to backtrack and touch a little bit. So first one being, can you tell people sort of what My North Langley is?
Well, I mean, Terry, you know, we've talked about this many times. My North Langley was an inspiration, that sort of bug that you put in my bonnet a long time ago without you really knowing. It was a birth out of an event that you put on with a couple other people called Twestiful here locally, which was a place to get people in the same room that knew each other online, but maybe not knew, but didn't know each other in person. And so when I went to that event, I got to have these really great conversations with people. Like, it was the fourth time or fifth time that we had met, and it was really the first time we had met because there was context and there was some conversation prior to the event online. It made that first initial face-to-face meeting so much more valuable and enjoyable. So we left that event, my friend Tyler and I, thinking, why couldn't we do something like that in our community on an ongoing basis, where people would have the ability to connect and share and exchange with each other? Then the hopes was that if they met offline, there'd already be this context and this relationship with each other. So on April 4th, 2011, like a week after your event, we launched My North Langley, and it has been a very fulfilling part of my life and Tyler's life the last 3 years.
Right, and it lives on Facebook.
Yeah, primarily Facebook, absolutely, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
It acts as this like amazing space where everyone in the community can sort of connect, ask their questions, crowdsource information, all these other great things that you've built there.
Yeah, the crowdsourcing thing is something that's come along in the last year and a half where people just started asking questions. And so I'd post the odd one. And now it's like daily where people come to us and ask, you know, I need a new piano teacher, or I need some landscaping done, or whatever. I mean, the questions that we get sometimes shock me of how I've never thought of that as a need, sort of a thing. So that part of it has been very, very exciting to see the feedback from people and how that information is crowdsourced. Yeah, it's been pretty neat.
It is really cool. It kind of reminds me of like when we were kids, it was all about the community center. That's sort of what your Facebook page has become, this sort of online community center. It's fabulous. Anyway, I just wanted to let people kind of hear that little piece because they might not know what that is. Also, you're in a team here, a very successful real estate team with Little Oak Realty,
yeah.
And you're doing very, very well that way. And you're one of the most influential realtors in the space because for a multitude of reasons, but Mobile Agent TV, maybe you can, for some people, if they're living under a rock, don't know about it. I think I'm personally so inspired by what you've done. You are a natural on camera. It's like you were meant to do this. And every week there are absolute golden nuggets for agents trying to improve their business, particularly when we're talking about technology and systems and tools and that sort of thing. Like, what was the catalyst for that?
Well, that's another great story. I mean, it might be actually become part of the conversation that we have in the next little bit here, Terry, but it came very much like My North Langley, as an opportunity that I didn't see coming, and it just came and I saw it and we jumped on it. I was asked to speak on a panel at RE/MAX R4, which is the big RE/MAX International conference in Las Vegas a year and a half ago. And I was going to speak on a panel with another gentleman named Dave Faulkware. And the person that was going to do the panel with us was out of or that was going to moderate the panel was out of RE/MAX LLC in Denver. And I suggested prior to the event, why don't we all get on a Google Hangout and get to know each other and build a little bit of context, which I think is so important, and then talk about what we wanted to talk about. And then we got on that, a Google Hangout, and then Kevin said very, very quickly, you know, the two of you need a TV show. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to say. I had never met Dave before, but we got along well. We were kind of, two sides of the same coin.
Yes.
And we got on a week later with another private Google Hangout. Kevin said, you guys need a TV show. And 4 days later, 5 days later, we were on the air. We were actually on the air prior to Dave and I ever meeting in person. So that's just, I see these opportunities and I go, why not? Well, let's see where it goes.
See, this is where you and I are really different. I've been working on conversations that matter for, months.
Yes, I've been pushing you for months.
Yeah, exactly. I appreciate the encouragement. I really do. So, okay. So we are going to dig in a little bit deeper, but I do want people to sort of, this part of my vision with Conversations That Matter is we get a chance to get to know the person a little bit more than just, what we know that they do for a living and more than just the regular stories that we typically hear. I kind of want to dig in a little bit deeper and we've talked about this, so you know where it's going, but I definitely wanted to talk a little bit about, because you and I share a lot of the same values, and how we wanted to design our life and our careers was sort of both important to both of us. And we've talked a little bit about some of the struggles that you've faced over the years. And maybe let's start a little bit further back. And let's go with, you mentioned to me when you were a young boy, you were involved with 4-H. You were raised on a farm, right?
Yeah, that's
right.
So
why don't you, you had said to me at one point that that was quite meaningful to you. And I wondered if you would share that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was meaningful on a lot of really different levels. I think one of the biggest impacts it had with me was the friends that I had through that organization, because they weren't forced friendships. Because we weren't in the same classroom or in the same school hallway, there was effort maintaining those relationships, which with high school friends, there isn't that effort. You're together every day. You're forced to be together. So sometimes these real relationships I found in school weren't as deep or as real as the friendships that I had, through the 4-H program. So I developed some really amazing, to this day, fantastic friendships. But one of the real life lessons that I had out of 4-H was the 4-H motto, was sort of learn to do by doing. And if those people that don't understand what 4-H is, it's not run by the adults at all. I mean, we are put out there as 8 to 18-year-old kids to sort of find our own way and fail and figure out how to balance the sheet and how to raise money and how to book to go to these different events, and the parents sit way, way back in case we are going to make an obvious mistake. They might pipe up, but we're left alone to make our own mistakes. Where I know for my kids' baseball and hockey, it's very, very well organized. All the kid actually has to do is just show up. Their gear's there for them. The sponsorship's in place. The ice is booked for them. So we were taught really early on to sort of learn from the older people in the club that had made mistakes prior to us. Don't do this, avoid doing this. This is what we've learned along the way. And then we were very, very, we were encouraged to make mistakes and learn from them. And I think that's one thing in our society that we really shy from letting our kids do, especially in our school system, is to let people make mistakes. And anyone who's made a mistake, it's the best lesson you've ever made, and the one that you actually really put into your core is the ones you've made yourself. So that's been a great lesson, to go ahead, try something. If it doesn't work, what have I learned from it, and move on. So that has been a big impact on my life for certain.
That's really interesting, and just makes me want to ask actually a further question, which is why do you think that we as a society don't, like, we hide our mistakes? If you make a mistake, it's a piece of shame that we hide, and we don't share it with the world. We tend to go quiet and duck and cover and just sort of wait till the dust settles and come back out and pretend that everything's wonderful again. Why do you think we do that?
It's safe. I don't know. And I don't know why, and I think what it encourages us to do is to play down the middle. You know, like if I was a kid in high school now with all the cool technology and all this stuff, if I tried to think outside the box, and I think it's a really ambitious thing to do, what happens if that doesn't sit well with the teacher and the teacher gives me an F? And instead, I'm just going to write the same essay in the same way that it's been written forever, and I'll take my B+ and I'll move on. You know, I just don't think we're encouraged to take those risks at fear that we will fail. And it's this really, really negative word. And I don't see that at all. It's the reason why all of our drugs that we take are you know, with a number behind it, because it was the 15th or the 150th formula. And every single time there was an error, it was, in their opinion, further progress to finding the solution, and they don't see it as an error or a failure. I don't know. I think it's a really sad statement that we have, because it just keeps people inside that box. They don't think differently. And I think people that are really successful aren't afraid of failure. I'm certainly not. I think of all the failures I've made, and I've had a lot of them, the enjoyment we all have, the enjoyment of the successes I've had because I took a risk far outweigh any of the pain of the failure. Or far outweigh them, and I've learned something. I've grown from them.
Well, I know. I mean, we've had conversations like this before, where I really feel like every time I fail. Well, you might have seen. I wrote a post last year. I was working at a PR firm very, very briefly. I got in. I realized, nope, not a fit. Got out. Wrote a post about it. I was pretty open about it because I thought, well, people are going to find out anyway, and I have to say, I did have a moment of going, oh God, what's everybody going to think, you know? And you worry about your reputation. You worry about your failures and how that's going to be perceived, because so much of our successes are linked to, I think, your reputation and your character and how people see you. And so I think it is important. I think we do sort of want to mitigate, you know, how we're perceived in the world. Kind of a tough one.
Absolutely. I mean, that post that you wrote, I know, I remember it quite well. I reached out to you afterwards and I said how inspired I was by it, because I look at that as being like, I think that's a great thing to be aware of, that to take that life lesson, to take that knowledge and move on. I think it's a very positive thing, but I don't think the majority of society, especially was taught to us, you know, in the school system, doesn't let you fail. And that's, you know, that's where we sort of build our habits, is in that school system. So I'm not blaming the school system. I'm just like, that's just where we've all learned failing's bad.
Well, and there is a shift. And I mean, I have kids that are older than your small children. You have two lovely young boys and a lovely wife. And my children, when they were young, there was still a certain, like, well, my oldest son, who's going to be 26, when he was in elementary school, there was still a certain level of competition. It had been dummied down to a degree, but there still was, you know, you didn't get a ribbon necessarily if you just participated. And now it's, you know, every child gets recognition, a nod, a pat. It doesn't matter what they do. And I can remember as a young mother, you know, loving that there was this inclusion and that, you know, no child was made to feel like he wasn't good enough or whatever, you know, we were obviously concerned about. And in the end, we've seen the pendulum swing back. And now it's, of course, every child just expects. And there's this sort of, element of expectation that I should be given something that I don't need to necessarily achieve. But then there's the other side of that coin too, which, and I mean, I, in our world, in the digital world, we see a lot of, what's the word? I don't quite know how to phrase it, but there's like just sort of outcome. We're very outcome driven yes. world. And I think what's lost, some of the magic that gets lost, is like we talk about just now about, you know, the process and the journey and a lot of what's going on that didn't work or didn't fit into the square peg, round hole, it still had value. And so I'm rambling on without a real specific question. I guess my question is, how do you think what could we do? What would you like to see in the future in terms of preparing children better for life? In so, like, you know, as we've launched careers and life and marriage and family and all those things, what are they missing?
Well, I that's a really, really tough question. And one of the things I said I loved about this conversation is that I think when these conversations that we're having right now that are really deep and meaningful, it's okay to say, I don't know. I don't know. I think it's a role of a parent. I think it's a role of trying to let them. And it's very important to me. And you and I have talked about this before. I think the journey is so missed out on, the opportunity to actually enjoy the journey. And I think that's unfortunate that we're so focused on the destination, that if that destination takes 15 years to get to, that somehow those 15 years that took to get there shouldn't count as you know, meaningful years of your life. And I love the journey. I've tried to set up my life that the journey is the destination, or at least the part of the, you know, it's like going on a road trip. You know, the vacation should start once you get in the vehicle, not when you'll get there, right? You should have the right tunes and the right snacks and you should go hit the road. But I don't know. I think it's parents. I think it's parenting. I think without being too harsh, my parents took a lot of onus on raising me and trying to do the right thing. And I think we're trying to push that off to society and off to schools, and we're not bringing it in home as much. I think it's the responsibility of parents to sort of teach these life lessons. I know I was taught, you know, through 4-H and through my parents a lot about financing. I had to balance the book that we fed our animals with, and then we took the animals off to auction, and then we had to take the amount of money we got from those animals, and then we had to do a profit and loss balance sheet, you know, at the age of 10 or 12, and it taught me about finances. Where my wife, you know, she wasn't really taught about finances. And when we met each other, she didn't know those sort of simple things. So, yeah, I think that's for the education process or the education system to do. But I think some onus has to be put back on the parents. And we need to prepare them for the world. We're aware of what it's like. We're in there every day doing it. So we need to prepare our kids better, I think, as parents.
I love that. I love that answer. And I tend to agree with you. And I love that there's programs like 4-H for the kids that fall through the holes, too. Because, you know, not all parents are equipped, I think, to deliver that kind of education. And your parents sound like they're pretty awesome, which kind of leads me to, like, you started working for them also at quite young, didn't you?
Yeah, I joined them as an assistant when they were when I was 15 years old. So my mom became an agent around that time. My dad joined them, joined my mom later on, and I worked with them as an assistant. I loved the business right then. Became an agent on my 19th birthday, but didn't join the family business like a lot of second generation realtors or third generation realtors. My parents didn't want me to be a part of it. They wanted me to go cut my own teeth once again, sink or swim, learn to do by doing sort of an attitude. They weren't going to help me out at all. So I went out and I said, I starved. I mean, I was 19 years old in a market that was difficult. I couldn't grow a mustache. I looked like I was 16 years old. But it taught me how to work. It taught me to learn the business. I tried to learn the business so well that if I knew that if a buyer and seller let me open my mouth, if I could open my mouth and let them know that I knew what I was talking about, I'd be okay. And it was hard. And I'm super glad it was hard, because I think it's really set me up now to understand what it takes to be successful.
Yeah, that's remarkable to me. Like, and you know, I bleed for new agents. I really feel like it's a tough gig getting started in this business, and often they are left to sort of figure it out. But like you say, you know, you worked with your parents who had the business, but you still were expected to kind of figure a lot of it out on your own. So, you know, hadn't planned on going down here, but while we're here, if you wouldn't mind, like, what are some of the things that you learned as a new agent that you still do today? Like, are there, you know, like, is there anything that's really changed for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the a really great lesson I had was there was a kind of a scruffy looking guy. He would come into the office on floor shift sometimes, and he would ask about really high end real estate. Back then, I'm talking about $400,000 and $500,000, but back then you could get a house for 120 grand, right? He would talk about high end real estate, and no one would give him the time of day. Well, he'd come in and I'd help him and I'd serve him and I'd show him the new listings that were out there, and I'd ask if he didn't need anything, and I'd follow up with him. And every agent was saying, Michael, you're wasting your time. This guy doesn't have two nickels to rub together. You're wasting your time. Well, first of all, I didn't think I was wasting my time, but it also gave me an opportunity to learn how to talk to people and present them with information. And I had nothing better to do. I was starving. So he would come in regular and I'd take really good care of him. And it turns out he was a very, very wealthy guy. And he ended up buying a piece of real estate through me. And he said to me, you know, Michael, I really appreciate you always took really good care of me. You always talked to me, you know, really well. And you always said you were going to do what you're going to do. And you know, our motto from 20 years is do what you do so well that people come back and bring others with them, a Walt Disney quote. And that's the lesson. If there's one thing that I've learned, is take care of people. You don't have to worry about anything else. Just take good care of them. The rest of it will take care of itself.
I love that. I love that. But now you don't just take great care of people. You also innovate. You're also doing all these crazy things with your business. You've become quite a beacon, actually. A lot of people watch to see what you're going to do. Where did all that come from? You've been quite inspiring.
I think the world has come towards my skill set. I think the real estate industry has changed and society has changed towards my skill set. And my skill set happens to be a crazy curiosity. I am about all aspects of life. I'm curious. And I think that's the only barrier to entry for people today in any form of business. The information's out there. You can Google anything. The question is, do you want to find out how to do something different? Do you want to learn a new skill? Because it's not about access to information anymore. It's about being remotely curious about what you want to do. And when I see people do something that I want to be able to do, and you know this, Terry, I pick up the phone, have a cup of coffee. What are you doing? How are you doing it? Why are you doing it? What's working? What's not working? A buddy of mine, on a completely different tangent, he was putting in a tile floor in his house. I said, can I come watch you put on a tile floor? I sat there and watched over his shoulder for half a day, asked him 24 questions, and then I came home and I tiled my own house, right? So I just think curiosity is this amazingly precious gift that we have in today's society, and it might go back to learn to do by doing, figure it out, ask the right questions, do something different. I think that's my skill set is just this curiosity. And when you say, there's still a lot of great information on Mobile Agent TV, it's not me bringing up all that great information. It's about having these great guests come on where I get to ask them my curious questions and find out what they're doing. And other people get to listen in on that and get those nuggets. And if I happen to have something to say on the topic, I certainly will. But it's like, I just want to know what people are doing. I want to know what's working for them. And that's probably the thing that's pushed us farthest the most, and both my partners are willing to learn and they're curious too as well. But curiosity is a very, very valuable asset.
I completely agree. I'll throw in, I think also it's your, you have this fabulous imagination. Like, vision is 9/10 of it, I think. If you can't see it, you can't get there.
Yeah.
So I think if you have to be able to imagine what it is that you want to even explore and then get in and get curious. I love that. I think that's actually I do agree. It's a big gift and I'm glad you got it because the show is awesome. Anyway, so now we've touched a little bit about, how you've kind of gotten to where you are and you're doing so well, and I'm so proud of you, and it's really fun to watch your growth. But there was a time when things weren't fabulous. You've gone through some challenges like everybody else. Sorry, I'm just going to plug in here because I'm worried about it. I'll edit that out. There we go.
Leave it in. It makes it real.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, so there was a point not long ago that you battled some depression. And yeah. It's very interesting to me. I literally this morning just saw a TED talk. It was an officer who'd been, he'd been an officer in the San Francisco area for, I don't know, 23 years or something. And his beat was included the Golden Gate Bridge. And he used to go and talk people down off the bridge. And that was a big part of his job. And now he goes around talking about mental illness and suicide prevention and all these other things that are pretty intense. And the statistics he threw out, and I'm sorry, I can't remember everything, but there's a large number of people that battle mental illness. I myself have battled some depression, and I know that you also have battled some depression, and you're so lovely to be willing to talk about it. Where did you want to start with that? It's such a big topic.
Yeah, it is a big topic, and I'm happy to talk about it. I guess the trigger of why it happened is it doesn't necessarily mean anything because for everyone it can be anything that triggered it. But I was in a car accident in 2009, and through the process of being in pain and not sleeping and through that over a course of about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, I slipped into a depression, and at its worst it was. Pretty bad, like pretty scary. And I wasn't diagnosed with a depression for quite some time. And which was the worst thing ever, was to sort of feel like there's something wrong or what's going on. And I was very aware that things were different. I had a child before I got in a car accident in 2006. So I had my first kid, my wife and I had my first son. And then my other son was born just prior to the car accident. And I remember seeing them play as he grew up, and I wasn't participating the same way, and the joy wasn't there. And I found myself continually isolating myself and making excuses to hang out with friends, and really being absent of emotion, both positive and negative, just sort of being without emotion. And then became quite a struggle with my relationship with my wife, who I love dearly, and we've had an amazing relationship. But being around someone like that constantly, when we didn't know the reasoning behind it, was extremely difficult for her. I was going to see doctors for all my physical symptoms, but there was no help or support or awareness of that there was something else going on. Started, you know, losing friendships and work became a struggle. I think I was very good at putting on an act. I think as most people that battle with this thing, and I can only speak really for my issue. And then I was in my doctor's office one day, and my doctor, thank goodness, just said to me, you know, Michael, there's something wrong with you. You're just not the same guy as you used to be. And he handed me an evaluation, an assessment test. And it was like every single one of those questions were written by my wife, and they were meant for me. Like there was no, that doesn't apply to me. It was like someone looking into my soul. These questions were so poignant and cutting. So I filled it out and I handed it back to my doctor, and my doctor says, you know, I want to see you next week. And I went in next week, and he said, you know, here's what I think is going on. I think you've got depression. I think, you know, we got to put an action plan together. And just that, just the fact that I knew that there was perhaps a solution for it, that it wasn't me, because for the longest time I thought I was just a colossal jerk. And substitute the jerk word for a word that starts with an A. And which I was wondering, why am I? I've always been so laid back and sort of obnoxiously fun to be around. My friends are always like, I'm always too much energy. And here I was, a completely different human being. But once I knew it wasn't, there was a chance that there was something to fix it. There was a way to save my marriage. And at that time, it was getting like I had to save my marriage. And not that my wife didn't love me. It's just, I could only imagine what it was like to be around me. I can only imagine what it would be like to be around me, especially at the thought that there wasn't a solution. You know, she was 2 years into this totally different man in her life, and sort of an absent, emotionally absent father too as well. But once there was help, I did whatever it took to get better. And I remember speaking with a psychologist probably. And, you know, I was so desperate to become the Michael Thorne that I was prior to the car accident. And he was very clear. He says, you'll never be that guy again. You might actually be a better guy or a different guy, but that was 5 years ago. Even if the car accident never have happened, whoever we are 5 years later is never the same person we were before. You're always continually moving and evolving into something new. And he said to me, you know, there will be a silver lining to this. You will look back and there will be a silver lining going through that. And about a year ago, I really got a really good grip on it. And with the help of my wife and my friends and medication and counseling, I'm healthier mentally than I've ever been before. My marriage is better than it was ever been before. And I will tell you, I am very, very thankful that it all happened to me, because I was forced to become very, very clear. And that's a gift that I think a lot of us don't have, is that, you know, you have to stare at everything and take stock of everything in your life, figure out what you're willing to work on to keep. And if it's just going to be a burden for you, you've got to let it go, because you only have so much energy and so much focus to fix what you need to fix. So figure out what's important and start working on that. So it's been, I would never wish anyone to go through it, but I can take something away from it, positive.
I'm just so grateful that you're healthier and you're happier, and obviously it's affecting like all of your life. You know, the work that you're doing is so fabulous. And I just think, you know, how many people suffer in silence and don't get the help that they need, and, you know, lose hope even. And I think that's just, it's such a painful, journey, but it is, I know I've also battled with it. And I do know that on the other end, there is always, you know, hope and help and a new life. And so thank goodness we got you through that. I'm really glad you're happier.
You know, and one of the things too, and what I want people to understand about it is my impression of what depression was is sadness or anger or regret or stress. I had two amazing boys at the time that I fell into a depression. I have glorious friends. I have the most amazing wife. I have a financially successful business. And what do I have to be depressed for? Like, that was my huge thing. Why? Like, me, I've got nothing to be depressed for. I know people that should be depressed, and I'm not one of them. And I'd say that to my doctor and to everyone around me, but that's not what it's about. Depression and sadness, or depression and anger, or depression and regret are two completely different, separate things. And it will just choose you, like diabetes will choose you, or whatever. Like, you can't put that on someone. I happened to be in a car accident. I happened to not sleep so well for a year or so. And those sort of stresses caused this to happen. But you can have everyone that's got everything figured out. Just because you've got everything figured out, not that I had everything figured out, but I had my life together, doesn't make you immune to this. And I think people assume that their friends that perhaps might be going through it, that can't possibly happen to them because they've got their life together. So be aware that it can really just tap anyone on the shoulder. And and thankfully, I was never, ever in the Golden Gate Bridge scenario. I was never, ever remotely close to that. But I feel for anyone who is, because I know how trapped and how absolutely alone I felt, even though I was surrounded by great people. It's pretty scary.
I completely agree. And that's sort of that, you sort of sense that, you know, there's something wrong with you, that you're weak, that, you know, you should be able to handle these things. And like I experienced very much the same things that you described there, where you just think, wow, what's wrong with me? You know, like, I have it pretty good, and I should write more in my gratitude journal, and then I'll be better, you know, or something like that. And of course, it just isn't that simple. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. That is such a very deeply personal story. And I think that it is important to talk more openly about these really important subjects. Along the same lines, we've also talked about, you know, designing your life and happiness, and you know, you sort of touched on it a little bit there about, you know, what really matters to you in your world, and like your relationships always seems to be a really strong thread for you throughout your life. And I mean, that is certainly my experience knowing you as well. You're so focused on your relationships. You know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, different levels of careers. You know, we know you have a very successful business, and you're very happy with the business that you've built. You have this great team with two wonderful ladies, and you're doing great business, and you're known, and it's growing every day. Talk to me a little bit about how you've designed your life, why you've designed it that way. You know, a little bit along that, you know, we've talked about life balance, and I think that's sort of kind of where I see this going a little bit.
Yeah, I think it's a very, very interesting topic, and one that we don't speak about enough. We're so focused on one point of it. And I forget who it was, if it was a famous saying, or someone asked me one time, they said, so what do you do? And our response, our instinct is to respond with what is on our business card, right? That's our instinct. But what happens if the answer is, what do you do? How about if that answer is, I go fishing with my kids on the weekend, and I play poker once a month with my buddies? Why do we assume the question is, what do you do, as what we do for income? But that's how our society has led us to be, is to be work first and everything second, or to our identity to be very rooted in what we do to put money in the bank. And I think that's how we define success quite often. How successful are you? Are you the assistant manager, or are you the manager? Opposed to, I've got an amazing relationship with my wife and awesome kids. You know, that's success. Or I've taken time off and I smell the roses every week, and that's success. So, coaching my kids' baseball team. So one of my ambitions in life was, one of the reasons why I married my wife along with amazing, well, the fact that she wanted to marry me was a huge factor, because I married up. One of the things was she was very clear of what she wanted her life to look at. Even when we met, I was young too, but she was quite young when we met, and she knew what she wanted from life, which I found very, very attractive. I knew what I wanted from life, and there's not too many people, unfortunately, you know, in their late teens, early 20s, they even have a clue of what they want to do. And I don't know how fortunate I am that I knew what I wanted to do. But I told her earlier on, I have an ambition to be a fantastic father. I always had this ambition to be a great dad. That's what I wanted to do. And so I wanted a career that would let me do that. I wanted to have a life that would let me do that. And so that's my success. I mean, I love to have business success because of the enjoyment and the thrill that I get out of it, and the hobby that is my job. But that's not how I define my success. And I think it's unfortunate, as you do too as well, Terry, that that's how a lot of people define their success.
I absolutely do. And we've talked about this at length. But it's funny. I also feel like, you know, we tend to hang around with or become or develop relationships with people who are similar to us or share similar thoughts and feelings, obviously, which is why we're such good friends. But one of the things that I've often thought too is that there isn't room for difference. It seems like it's like everyone just expects. So when I talk about being a realtor, it's like everyone just imagines the top producing, you know, super achiever, working nonstop, you know, juggling all the balls, doing tons of volume, making tons of money. And there's just sort of this one size fits all. And if you aren't that, and I think the industry is a little bit guilty of, you know, fueling that, because there's all the competition inside your brokerage, you know, and I often thought that was really misguided. I thought, you know, there's a stigma around not being a certain age. And if you're not medallion, then you're not considered successful. And I think this is, I hadn't been willing to really talk about it prior to recently, but the truth is I never had any desire to be that agent. I was focused more on being available to my kids and staying home, and still obviously wanted to do a great job. And I definitely wanted to be successful in terms of doing it very, very well and building it slowly over time. I wonder if, you know, like we see a lot of people in our world, chastise and there's a lot of criticism and judgment. And I'm wondering, you know, how would you define a successful realtor?
The amount of hours in the day that you're happy. Like, that's success to me, whether it's agent or not. Like, if you're unhappy and you're miserable because you're working too much, then you're not a very good realtor. If you're unhappy because you're not doing enough work, you're an unhappy realtor. You're an unhappy human being. Like, you're unhappy. So, you know, I want to go to bed at night, wouldn't put my head on the pillow, knowing I did a kick-ass job for my clients, but I wouldn't take on an extra client at the expense of not being able to coach both my kids' little league teams, or to spend time with my family, or to spend a little time on me. Success to me, like, we measure it in one way. We measure it in the bank account, and that's how we keep score. And we talked about this too as well. A great agent, and we don't have to say names, who I have a ton of respect for, talked about legacy. In fact, my co-host on Mobile Agent Team talked about legacy, talking about I have to continue to grow my business, and I have to keep pushing forward, and I have to become this big team because I owe it to my kids to build them, to provide them a legacy. And I'm only assuming they mean financial legacy, where I would like to have my kids have a legacy where their dad did awesome stuff with them and all these memories and have these relationships. So I would love to have an unbelievable relationship with both my kids when I'm in my 60s. You know, so that to me is a legacy not only for me but also for my kids, and not at the expense of not getting them into a good school and putting a roof over their head and giving them the opportunities that I do, or my wife and I can, because we both work really hard. But to me, that also has to factor into that legacy. It can't just be a bank statement. If your kids are miserable and you have no friends, but you're wealthy in the bank, I don't have that ambition. I'm not hooked up that way. I can't do that. Do we have a great business? Absolutely. Are we successful? In my terms, I think we're extremely successful. All three of us, my teammates, I think we're extremely successful. Are there bigger producers out there? Yeah, there are people that do more business. I think we're extremely successful.
Well, I do too. And so I guess the question then is how have you designed it? Because I think, like, honestly, I imagine that, you know, you don't take every client probably.
No, we don't. That was a very good lesson early on that if it's not the right fit, if your gut says this isn't going to work out, listen to your gut. And the odd time you'll be wrong, but not at the expense of how many times you'll be right. You know, you will be right. One of the words that bug me the most in my life is the word luck. There's something about the word luck that really, it really grinds me. My friends will come to me and we'll say what we're doing, or we're putting in this, or we're going on vacation. And my friends will say, oh, you guys are so lucky. And the word luck undermines my hard work that my wife, or, you know, that I've put into my job. I prefer the word fortunate. And I think for some cases we are fortunate. I'm fortunate to be born in Canada. I'm fortunate to be born to amazing parents. And so there are some things that I'm fortunate. And one of the things I'm fortunate about is to have met and built a team with Jorda and Trish that both define success between the two of them in the same way I do. You know, Trish had a baby 6 months ago, 7 months ago, and it didn't hiccup our team. We knew that it was a priority for her for have her kid. And her kid comes to the office with us. We went up yesterday and looked at a piece of property about 4 hours out of town. Trish and I went and we took Malia with us, because the family's important. So if there's one thing I am fortunate when it comes to having life work balance, is that I have two partners that encourage me to have a very balanced life so that I don't feel guilty for not working more, and I encourage them also to have a balanced life. I think we're finding the right partnerships is extremely hard. And we have a unique team. I think there's a lot of these team leaders with a team underneath them. I understand how that works. Very, very boss employee type of a thing where we have a partnership. I think we're rare, and I think it makes us extremely fortunate.
I completely agree. And in fact, there's so few that I've seen that have been really, really successful. Although I have seen, and they are starting to crop up a little bit more and more, which is interesting. Why do you think that is? Just side note.
Teams? I think teams are absolutely the way it's going to go. I think one of the reasons why we've been able to push the envelope the last few years is because we are a team. The personalities that are required to make a great agent, the 7 different personality traits or the 8 different personality traits, rarely exist in a single person in a large enough amounts to make the perfect agent. There are so many things about this job that I just don't like to do. I just don't like to do them. This comes back to happiness. I am fortunate to have someone like Jorda who thinks those things that I don't like to do, she likes to do. So I get to trade her the things I don't like to do for the things that she doesn't like to do, which happens to be the things I like to do in front of the camera, being creative, pushing us forward technology-wise. And Trish also is a different personality. A team with 3 people that are the exact same personality doesn't offer the client nor the team a whole lot of benefit. The fact that we get along personally, but we are very different, is the reason why our team works. And so I think teams that go out and identify their weaknesses and plug holes to fill those weaknesses, I think there is a mistake that our parents, my parents, and our generation's parents have taught us, and I've spoken about this before, is this ability to be well-rounded. We want our kids to be well-rounded. I'm dyslexic. I'm never going to be a great speller. I'm never going to be a great reader. That's the hand I was dealt. We should find what we're good at and play to those strengths. And that is something I've embraced more and more the last 5 or 6 years, especially in work. I've just said I'm all in with my strengths. I'm all in with being a lot more who I am in front of the camera and in meetings around other agents, not trying to be well-rounded. If you don't, yeah.
I was just going to say Marcus Buckingham is a big, important coach. He's been on Oprah and all these other shows talking about playing to your strengths, precisely that. And I don't know why we as a generation or a society or, you know, who knows how long this has gone on, but we tend to focus on our weaknesses and apply the theory that, well, we should, you know, invest stronger there because that's our weakness. Well, it makes absolutely no sense when you really think about it. It's like, why would you, you know, work so hard on that when you can be playing to your strengths and doing things that you're naturally good at? And I was going to say and interject, because when you started talking about playing to your strengths, I mean, when you send me a Facebook message, it's always a voice message and I love it. And you're like, well, I'm not going to spend time typing when I can easily just talk. And it's so much easier.
Typing's embarrassing for me. I see that red squiggly line far, far too often.
Totally.
So once again, I'll play to my strengths. I'm never going to be a written blogger. I'll never do that. I just don't have that strength, so I'm not going to try to. And I think that's, we have to really be very clear as we can about what our strengths are, because I think the reason why we're good at our strengths is because we enjoy doing them, and that's what makes us good at them. So not only do you get to play to your strengths, I think you end up being a lot happier because you're not trying to work on the stuff that you suck at. So play to your strengths, I think, is a huge thing that we need to do. And that's why, come full circle, back to teams. I think that's why teams will work going forward, is they will identify the things they're lacking and hire for that position and make a team stronger. I think teams will continue to be a dominant play in real estate moving forward.
It is very interesting to me. And I also think, you know, just along the business theme here for a second, that as a team, you can actually build a business. When you are a realtor selling, it's like every year you're starting your business all over again. And if you get sick or something happens to you, or, you know, that's it, you're out of work. So I think the team concept as a business model, you know, companies, this is how they operate. And I just think as a business model, it's very strong. And I'm excited to see, honestly, all kinds of different models. One of our good friends, Raj Kassar, down in Orange County, I think is doing an amazing job of setting an example of how they can establish teams. I'm going to be going down to Seattle to see the Divas here pretty quick next week. And they've just, you know, completely blown it up and completely made something brand spanking new, which is so fun. So just, I love that you're doing that.
But on that note, Terry, too, as well, I think what teams will also allow you to do is fail. I don't think a single agent has the capability to do something for it to land flat on his face and to lose those 2 months worth of effort, where Raj or our team can say, let's devote 5% and try this new avenue, try this new marketing trick, because it doesn't affect the whole team, right? It's only a little bit of energy. So you can try these new things, look at the analytics, measure them. Do they work? Then you can think outside the box. When you are a solo agent, back to the beginning conversation, you're just trying to get that B+. You're not trying for the A+. You're just trying to get it done. Do a good job or a good enough job. Teams let you be a little creative. I'll run an idea past Trish and Jordan, and I'll say, you know, give me 4 hours next week to try this out. 4 hours is yours. Knock it out of the ballpark. Where, you know, a single agent doesn't have the ability to play and to test and to be curious as much. So I think that's another huge advantage.
That's huge. And I love that. I love that you do that, because I don't know that everybody in this industry is doing that. You know, I think a lot of people have been doing sort of the, well, this is how I do my business, and I don't want to even learn how to do it any other way. So I applaud you for the attitude, honestly. Like I said, you always inspire me. I love watching to see what you'll do next. There was one other thing that I wanted to touch on before we finish and wrap here. And this is something that I think I'll be closing all of my conversations with, because again, it's along the lines of, you know, something a little more meaningful. But this has been such a rich conversation. I know we could go on and on, and, you know, we'll probably end up doing a bunch of these as we go.
We could.
And again, thank you so much. But so my final question is, imagining, and we've already sort of touched on this, but imagine you're nearing the end of your life. You know, you look back at your life and you say, you know, what was meaningful to me? What is the legacy that I want to leave?
It will be family. I mean, ultimately it will be family. We're so fearful. This don't look back, look forward. Well, we're all building to a point in our life where we'll only look back, right? You will be aware, hopefully at some time aware, that you don't have a forward, you only have back. And I think we should be brave enough to look back and hopefully feel that what we built or left behind was of value, which still has purpose, where you did laugh enough, right? Like my regret is a big thing. My dad is an awesome guy. My dad, after his boys were raised, three boys, my dad and my mom started traveling, like living in a hut in northern Mongolia, traveling, like crazy, crazy traveling. And my dad would say to me every single time I dropped him off the airport, he says, "Michael, if this is the trip that mom and dad don't come back on, remember, we have no regrets. We had a great life. Make sure the funeral is a great party and we love you." And then he would leave. And that would make me so, so sad. The thought that I don't want to think about my dad dying. I don't want to think about this. And now is the one of the most rewarding things I can hear any human being say to me is that he did it. He lived a life that he can now look back on and say, if I go down now, I don't have a regret. I lived this great life. I enjoyed my families. I lived a little bit of adventure. I had some great laughs. I had great friendships. I did something meaningful. The fact that he could honestly say that he doesn't have any regrets, that looking back, the rest of it's house money, you know, it's all gravy from here out. It's such an inspiring place to one day get to where I don't have these regrets. That's what I hope will be what I look back on, because that's what's real. You know what I mean? It's about when I went through my tough time, I had to get really clear about what was real, and what was real were my boys, my wife, and my friends and family. That's what was real. The rest of it, it's not real. I mean, it's real, but it's nowhere near the same value. I think I want to remember laughing a lot. I want to remember stopping. I think there's a lot of value in stopping, but definitely my family will be my legacy. I hope so.
Love it. Absolutely love it. I knew this was going to be a great conversation.
And Terry, we could do this many times. And I know you might be wrapping up, but I want everyone that might be listening to this, and unless this conversation is just about us, which I like, we can have this conversation, whether people listen to it or not, is another thing.
Exactly.
People will, because it's real. I have pushed you to do this for so much because what this conversation is about. It's about scratching the surface and thinking about it for ourselves and going deeper and realizing what's important. And there is value in what Mobile Agent TV does, and there is value in a lot of these type of programs that are out there for us, but there is real value in these sort of conversations, Terry. I am super excited that you're doing it. There couldn't be a better person that's doing it, because I think you really relish these things. I think this is a thrill for you, which is great, because you're really, really bite into these sort of conversations. And I am super, super excited to see where this takes you.
That is so sweet of you to say that. And I'm, you know, it might just be you and me just listening to this, but no matter what, I absolutely
love it. I'll let my wife listen to it.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. That's perfect. I just want to thank you so much, Michael. You've been so awesome. I believe, honestly, that some of the stuff that you've shared today that was so deeply personal will actually be of such huge value to anybody who gets a chance to hear it. So I personally want to just say I'm extremely grateful, and I know we'll do this again. So thanks a lot.
Absolutely. Thanks, Terry.
Let's wrap.